Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW Local Innovative Public Radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that lovely oasis of thought, we migrate to this lovely oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where, John, I've already posted a blog about meaning, music, and expression or something.
Well, congratulations to you, Ken, and to Music, Meaning, and Expression for the attention you've given it. Because today, folks, you're used to us talking or bringing you information, bringing you the music of philosophy in the way that no other program ever has in the history of the world. But today we're going to talk about the philosophy of music, and Ken's going to explain that whole concept to us in a few deft words right now.
I'm going to explain that whole concept. No, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be puzzled about music, because actually, I love music. I used to play lots of music, and I still listen to tons of music, but I'm puzzled about it. There are lots of sounds in the world, lots of beautiful sounds, ugly sounds. The music is some subset of the sounds in the world, but I don't know how to pick out that subset.
Well,
can you help me?
Yes, I can help you, but not much, because it is a baffling topic. Everybody pretty much agrees that music is somehow organized sound, but that's at most, and at most, because, of course, some philosophers come up with an exception to everything.
Speech is organized sound.
Yeah, it's at most a necessary condition, not a sufficient condition. Which organized sounds are music? People have thought, well, maybe music is essentially there to accompany speech, that is, singing. But that hasn't been true for a couple centuries.
It was true for a long time, though, right?
Apparently. I mean, we really don't know a lot about the music of the Greeks. The only music we know about is that was usually connected with religion or something and gets written down or talked about. But we do know quite a bit about the music the last few centuries, and it definitely is a lot of instrumental music and a lot of music whose point is clearly not to accompany speech, nor it seems to represent anything else.
Well, that raises another puzzle. Oh, music is mostly non-representational. You know, how can it? Why is it moves us incredibly? It arouses such emotions in us. But how could it do that? Look, when you have a novel, you get sad and happy because of the world that's represented. You respond to that. But if music doesn't represent anything, how come it moves us so much? It's just sound.
Well, that's a good question, because music was the first art that people recognized as not essentially representational. And then people thought visual art was, but then artists showed them wrong by producing a whole century of non-visual art. But frankly, that non-visual
art... So-called
art. Yeah. that non-representational visual art does not, for most people, connect as directly to the emotions as music does. You have to learn to appreciate non-visual art. I mean, everybody loves some kind of music. Most you have to learn to appreciate what people call the better music. It all connects to our emotions, but how and why?
Now, here's a question about that. I mean, a sad piece of music causes us, most of us anyway, to feel sad. It's kind of a universal response. Now, why is that? Is that because there's something in the music, like the sadness is in the music? Or is it just in our responses? But if it's just in our responses, why do we all respond the same way?
Well, this is makes the emotional features of music sound like what philosophers call secondary qualities, which isn't exactly an explanation, but it's a category. A secondary quality is something that isn't really in the thing that you attribute the quality to, but at least has a lot to do with the response that thing causes in you. So philosophers say colors are really secondary qualities because they have to do with the visual sensations they arouse in us. So is that the connection of music to the emotions? The emotions are like secondary qualities?
I don't think so. I think that there's something inside the music, some internal musical properties that kind of demands a certain kind of emotional response. Because look, think about it. If you change the chord just a little bit, it goes from being happy to sad. If you change it from major to minor, it goes from being, you know, upbeat to downbeat. So there's something about the music. And, you know, no, music is really catchy. It's infectious in this, its ability to do this to us. And to help us examine what happens when music just appears out of nowhere and refuses to leave you alone, we turn to Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, after centuries of singing in the shower, opera attending, fiddle playing, dancing, and yodeling, there's still disagreement about what music is exactly. As John Cage put it, there is no noise, only sound. If it's all just sound, though, why do some songs get stuck in our heads? The Germans have a name for this, of course, Ohrwurm. In English, that's earworm. James Kolaris, a professor of marketing at the University of Cincinnati, popularized the term. In 2003, he wrote that 74% of earworms are songs with lyrics, followed by commercial jingles, 15%, and instrumentals at 11%. Earworm episodes last a couple of hours on average and occur frequently among 61.5% of his sample. He also discovered that women are more irritated by earworms than men are, and almost everybody has had an earworm at some time or other. Sing along if you know it. Google earworm, and you will find scores of sufferers. Among earworms mentioned are these.
I want my baby back. Chillin' baby back with
barbecue sauce.
Hoot, hoot, hoot,
who let the dogs out?
Not to mention.
We will rock you.
It's hard work getting these out of your head.
Working 9 to 5.
Well, nigh impossible. And there are these.
Seasons in the sun.
How about this head stopper? And of course,
it's a small world after all.
One poor fellow had the lonely goat herd from Sound of Music stuck in his head. Another one had just one line from a song stuck in his head and couldn't remember the rest of it or what band had done it. And there's a woman who had Pink's Get This Party Started stuck in her head, only for some reason she was hearing it as Get This Starty Parted. That's just weird. Did I mention?
When something's going wrong, you must be bent.
There it is.
Stuck in the middle with you.
Of your head. Don't forget.
Little Red Corvette.
Can you remove these earworms?
We're gonna do it.
How? Well, there's the lobotomy.
Don't worry, be happy now.
Some suggest singing the earworm all the way through deliberately. Supposedly, that gets it out of your system. In my case, that wouldn't have worked because the only part of my earworm I could remember was. And I was damned if I was going to rent a copy of Grease just so I could sing along with a song that I hate. Others recommend singing other songs. Earworm sufferers say that Viva Las Vegas and Hava Nagila drive songs out of your head in a jiffy. Me, I finally got rid of my earworm by singing Go Down Moses in a booming baritone. Just goes to show there's a cure for everything if you know where on earth to look for it. Luckily for us,
it's a small world.
I gotta go.
Thanks, Ian. I think. Dum da dum dum dum.
Oh, please.
I'm John Perry. Yeah. I've got Small World going around in my head, but we're going to try to pursue this show anyway.
Yeah, we'll get that out of your head, I hope. I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're joined by Professor Peter Givey. He's the Board of Governors Professor of Philosophy at Rutgers University, an old stomping ground of mine. He's the author of many books about the philosophy of music, but pertinent to our subject today. He's the author of An Introduction to the Philosophy of Music. Peter, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much, Ken and John. I'm delighted to be here.
Hi, Peter. John Perry here. Thanks for joining us. I think you were on and heard Ken and I kind of fumble around about distinguishing between music and non-music. So now we got the expert on. You can give us some help. What makes music, what makes something music rather than mere noise? What makes something music rather than mere speech? Give us a clue.
Well, the first definition that you would get if you asked an undergraduate would be organized sound, which you said was a necessary condition for music, but clearly not a sufficient one. Of course, now it's not even a necessary one, since there is a whole school of random music. So there goes organized sound down the drain.
Does anyone listen to random music?
Well, few people listen to any of the music that's considered contemporary classical music, so it doesn't exactly distinguish that from any other kind of music. Very few people listen to Schoenberg, and that's certainly highly organized music. As I know both of you know, it's a philosophical sport to try and find definitions of things. It's a sport that's not practiced very much anymore by the philosophers I know. And just to give you an idea of how hard it would be to define music, why don't you play the beginning of the Mozart 41st Symphony, which I think you have on hand.
Well, I can hum it if we don't.
Okay.
Okay, now, That's beautiful music. There's no doubt in my mind that that's music. That's actually one of my favorite pieces of music.
Is that the one we call the Jupiter?
The Jupiter Symphony.
Yeah, that's
that
a great
Mozart's
piece of music.
Name.
That's a great piece of music. Okay, but that's easy. If all music was like that, it would be, you know, music is stuff like this, right? You could just point to that and say music is stuff like this, and it would be easy. But I've got a challenge for you. Try this one on for size, this piece by Verez called Ionization. So, let me ask you, Peter, what do these two pieces of music have in common that make them both music? I mean, the Verez thing is kind of cool, I mean, but you could hear it walking in the woods or something.
Somebody got them published and played, maybe that's all there is.
What is there to it that makes them both music?
Well, that was why I had them both played. By the way, before I came on the air, there was something on your station about a rap singer. Is rap music? I wouldn't want to be the person to say no.
I know why you wouldn't want to be the person to say no.
Is the Verez music? Lots of people who first heard it didn't think it was. And a very famous performer told Beethoven that he didn't think his Opus 59 quartets were music. And Beethoven replied, well, I didn't write them for you. I wrote them for the future. Hmm. My own idea is that I can't produce for you or for your listeners a definition of music in the classical sense, and it's not the way I start out doing the philosophy of music. I assume that there's a body of identifiable stuff that most of us would agree to be music, and my approach is to ask questions about that stuff. Let me just say one other thing. A composer, a very well-known one named Ernst Toch, who's probably not well-known now but was in the middle of the 20th century, wrote a piece, a very famous piece called The Talking Fugue. It was just talk, and it was talk constructed the way a fugue is constructed. Was that music? That's a good question.
How about no?
Why not? Maybe we shouldn't be too picky about what's music. Music is whatever people who make music say is music, and there's no
John, get a
essence or anything. Maybe that's the way, right?
John, get a hold of Toch's Talking Fugue if you can, and make your own decision.
Okay.
Actually,
I will do that. It sounds like music is one of these concepts that has more like a these paradigm central case than increasing penumbras of things that are as you get out towards the margins not clear cases of music.
Yeah,
is that a good way to look at the concept of music?
It's certainly a good way to start.
I think that part of that. Let me try this thought out on you, Peter. I think that part of the reason. Go back to that comment to quote to Beethoven. That comment to Beethoven. That's not music, right? Well, in some ways, when we call something music, we're honoring it, right? It's a kind of honorific term. We're expressing our appreciation of it as music. And some of this stuff that you don't like, you know, it's hard to separate out the expression of your disapproval of it from your acknowledging it as music, right? So could that be part of what's going on?
Well, that's quite right, Cannon. And philosophers of art have learned over the last 50 years or so to distinguish the question of what is art from the question what is good art, because frequently somebody says something like, you call that music?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning not to say they don't really think it's music, but they just think it's lousy music. But I think the man who said that to Beethoven was saying something a little deeper than
Well,
that.
Duke Ellington said there's just two kinds of music, good music and bad music. So maybe in a bit we'll figure out the difference.
Yeah, we'll get to your deeper take on what the guy was saying to Beethoven in just a little bit, Peter. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is music. Our guest is Peter Kivi from Rutgers University.
We've been looking at ways to separate music from non-music. In a little bit, we'll consider the emotional power of music and its ability to move us intensely.
Oh, 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 when it comes to comes out here, and it comes out here, comes out here.
Louis Prima, the music goes round and round and it comes out here. Well, the philosophy goes round and round and it comes out here on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
You're so clever, and I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the philosophy of music. And after you've made your pledge to KALW, we'd like you to join us on the air.
Music can be joyous or sad. It can give us a feeling of impending doom, or it can cheer us up, or it can fill us with unfulfilled longing. How can sound reach in and grab our emotions like that?
Tell us what you think. The number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. That's after you call 1-800-525-9917 to make a pledge.
You could also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Now, that has a melodic ring to it, philosophytalk.org. That could be an earworm if you're not careful,
Ken. That's true, and we want it to be an earworm. Our guest is Peter Kimby from Rutgers University. So, Peter, I want you to help me understand how music, especially wordless music, I can sort of understand how you put words to music, they have representational content, they represent a world to you, and that can make you feel things. But how can wordless music, why does it arouse such emotions? Joy, love, fear, longing? How does it do that?
It doesn't.
It doesn't? What?
That's right.
Tell me more. Do tell.
Well, let me just begin. The connection of music and the emotions, the question is the oldest question in the philosophy of music. It was asked by Plato, but of course, as John said early on, we know nothing about what Greek music sounded so we don't know anything about what Plato was really talking about.
Tell me about this provocative thing. Music doesn't arouse emotions in you. Tell me about that.
I didn't say it doesn't arouse emotion. It doesn't arouse the emotions you named,
which I
like to call the garden variety emotions.
Uh-huh.
I've spent about 20 years of my philosophical career trying to convince people that when we describe music in terms of the garden variety emotions, we're describing some phenomenological quality of the music, the same as when we describe it as turbulent or tranquil.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm a good amateur musician and a devoted lover of music, and music of the right kind moves me deeply, but it doesn't move me to the garden variety emotions.
So you're saying that what you said for 20 years wasn't right?
No, it was right. It's still right.
Right.
So wait a minute,
let's get clear about what your claim is.
It doesn't arouse anger, love, fear, joy, those kind of emotions that we feel response to all kinds of situations in the world. But what does it arouse in you? What is the thing that it does?
I think, if you agree with me that not every emotion has a name, it arouses a kind of love and enthusiasm for the music, if the music is lovable, beautiful music. It's easy to write sad music. Anybody can do it. There are all sorts of formulas for doing it. Does sad music deeply move you when it's bad sad music? Music deeply moves me when it's great, wonderful music.
I want to challenge you a little bit here, Peter. Okay,
I hope so.
I'm watching a horror movie. Right.
Right.
Take out the music. There's a fearful scene. You know, there's something lurking around the corner. The woman's walking and is going to leap out. It's scary. Add the music with that. And it slowly rises and it's not overdone. It's even scarier. So didn't the music arouse or at least enhance the fear? And so doesn't that directly refute your thesis?
Well, it makes the scene more vividly scary through the phenomenal property of scariness that is given to the music. But here's a different example. Try and listen to the scary music track of a movie and see if it moves you to anything at all.
Well, maybe scary movie tries to move you to one thing, but take a good John Philip Sousa march. Right now, I might listen to it, and I might not be filled with admiration for the music. I might think, well, that was one of his lesser efforts. But it does arouse something in me. I mean, a certain kind of desire to get up and march, if nothing else. Or how about Deutschland über alles? Now, that's a song that the person my age arouses a lot of negative emotions. But at the same time, it still manages to worm in amongst those negative historical emotions and arouse a certain kind of, you know, atavistic, patriotic feeling. Not for Nazi Germany or any kind of Germany, but just it's got that. It's got the nature of a patriotic song. It arouses that kind of emotions. How does your theory account for all of those kind of complex emotions?
Well, you sort of turned it on me. I thought you were going to ask, why does listening to Deutschland über alles fill me with horror and loathing? And it's because of the association that it arouses in me with Nazi Germany. The question of whether music arouses the garden variety emotions is whether it arouses them in an aesthetically relevant way. Lots of music arouses lots of garden variety emotions through associations. And Deutschland über alles is not a good example because it's got words as well. It originated, I think you may know, it was written by Haydn. And if you listen to it in its form in the quartet, where it is a theme and variations, I don't think it'll have that effect on you at all. Now, the other example you picked, the example of the Sousa March, well, of course, marches are designed to make you want to move, but that's a different thing from emotion, it seems to me. Yes, it's quite true that music tends to make you move, which is why it was used historically as accompaniment to work, because it's rhythmic and it aids you in behaving rhythmically in work.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy of music with Peter Kivi from Rutgers University. We want to know what you think. Does music arouse the garden variety emotions in you? Peter Kivi says, if you think that, you're wrong. Come on and argue with us. 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. And we have some emails now.
Yeah, we got a couple emails. Here's John from Berkeley who says, music of a kind which mimics musically what appears on the screen, ascending playing while the character goes upstairs, for example, is called Mickey Mousing. Usually snobs disdain this. But what is it about music that enhances or detracts from movies? And I'll throw in a second one, too, on a bit different topic. This is from our old pal Pete in San Francisco. He says, I've got this naive notion that great symphonic composers and great mathematicians operate on similar creative planes. He's right about that. I can define the plane as one I'm not on. Something to do with structure, notation, logic, and resolution. Are there any philosophical grounds for this assumption? So there's some things for you to chew on, Peter.
I'll address the second one first. There is a long-standing association of music and mathematics. It goes all the way back to the Pythagoreans, and it has to do with the fact that the Pythagoreans discovered the law of the division of the octave. I don't think music as an art form has any relation to mathematics except this. I have a friend who's a world-class astrophysicist, and I once heard him give a popular lecture, where he described the discovery of the formula for the pendulum as something that deeply moved him. I don't think he was just playing to the crowd. I think mathematicians are deeply moved by beautiful theorems. Beauty has played a large part in theoretical physics as a criterion of a good theory. Einstein is supposed to have said he knew his theory was right because it was so beautiful. And in that respect, in the respect that mathematics is a structure, a pure and beautiful structure, yes, in that respect, it's like certain kinds of music, namely the kind of music we associate with the great symphonic composers.
Let me take you to that other email and the point in there, because I think it's an important point, and I wonder how your theory deals with it, that music doesn't arouse the garden variety emotions. Take that part, the music that with which we introduce this segment, The Music Goes Round and Round by Louis Prima. Take that. That's a little joyful ditty, you know, kind of happy. Suppose you set the words of a funeral dirge. you made that into a funeral dirge. That would be completely inappropriate because there's like a mismatch between what you're saying and the music you're accompanying it
with. Kind of
the
spade goes
precisely.
Up and
yeah.
down.
That means that the music has an emotional character that demands.
Yes.
So I don't, but did I miss something in your view about that?
The music possesses cheerfulness in The Music Goes Round and Round. The music possesses cheerfulness as a perceptual property of the music. And of course you would detect a discontinuity if you set it to a funereal text, just as if you decorated a funeral hall with cheerful pictures of people dancing in the street.
So you think if we had a song that went up, the spade goes up and down, up and down, up and down, and the body ends up here, it would be slightly disrespectful to the...
Slightly. We have a lineup of callers on the line. Mary in Mill Valley, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. Am I on the air?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. A couple of things. In China, in Chinese legend, they called musicians the keepers of time. So that anyone who has a certain tempo or is able to create a certain tempo is creating music. Therefore, drums are considered music. And I wanted Peter Kibbe to talk about that it's the instruments require or evoke a certain resonance in a person, but music itself does not inherently have emotion. It's what it evokes in the listener. If there's no listener, then there's no emotion. So two issues. The one where music is really a certain tempo, keeping time, and a person is drawn into that tempo for that moment. And also instruments layering sound, which resonates to any particular listener.
Thanks, thanks, Mary. Peter, what do you think?
Well, that's a very good comment. Nothing I've said speaks against the notion of pure percussion being music. Indeed, I love percussion players, and there are pieces that have been written without any melodic structure at all. Indeed, the Varèse piece has no melodic structure, and it has things in it that aren't even musical instruments, which was one of the things that made it famous. Sirens, whistles. Of course, that's music. As far as when I said that that music possesses emotions as perceptual properties of the music, I wasn't implying that all music possesses those properties. Some music is not, I like to use the word expressive. Some music is not expressive at all in the sense of having emotional properties. That doesn't make it bad music. It just makes it different music. Stravinsky tried in his so-called classical period to remove all of the expressive properties from his music because it was a statement against romantic music, which of course was full of expressive properties in his view to excess. So the question of whether music has emotions as properties is a completely separate question from the question of whether it's good music, bad music, and I'm certainly not saying that all music possesses them.
Okay, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing music with Peter Kibbe from Rutgers University. What is the value of music? Is music a dispensable frill, pleasant but not serious, or is it somehow indispensable for a well-lived life and a well-ordered society?
We'll take up these questions plus more of your calls and emails in a second. The Beach Boys and I Can Hear Music. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the philosophy of music. Why does music matter? All things being equal, is a person who does not appreciate music somehow worse or worse off than a person who does?
And this is a timely question. I mean, all the children in our society are being raised and they're not being exposed to music at all. Some kids have never heard Hey Jude or any of the classics of the 60s that constitute the finest in the history of music. So tell us what you think about these issues of education and music.
Join us calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Or email us comments at philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Peter Kivi from Rutgers.
Now, Peter, we have a whole lineup of callers. They've been waiting a while, so I'm going to get some callers in here. Don in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Don.
Hi, how are you?
How are you? What's your comment or question?
My comment is I'm a choral singer and singing classical music, you know, and there's a feeling that I get, which I guess you can call an emotion, at certain times singing, you know, when we all come into unison at the end of a great, you know, stanza or, you know, just singing Beethoven's Ninth just brings up all kinds of body reactions and great feelings and warmth. I don't know, almost oceanic kind of feeling. So, you know, just being in a chorus when people are all coming together, or even when we're doing eight parts, you know, but it's all working and everybody's in time. It's an amazing experience, and I wonder what your guests think about that.
So here's a kind of a bunch of
feeling is like an emotion, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's but you also bring out the social aspect of some of these emotions that are involved. So what do you think, Peter?
Well, thank you for that question. It's a very good one, and it also speaks to me because I used to do a lot of choral singing myself, and I think it's one of the most wonderful ways to participate in music that there is. Of course, performing music is deeply moving, and I think if more people, to not put too fine a point on it, if more people had music lessons, fewer symphony orchestras would be in trouble because it's performing music that gives you the deepest insight into it and that, as the caller said, moves you the most deeply. I'm not, as I tried to make out before, I'm not denying that music is deeply moving. I can't think of anything more deeply moving than singing.
That's why you spent
the Ode to Joy.
That's why you spent the last 20 years trying to figure out how music manages to move us, right? Because you think it's deeply
moving.
Kevin in San Francisco is on the line. You want to ask Kevin about animals and music, I think, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So tell us your question.
Yeah, my question is, I mean, obviously animals can't figure out mathematical problems for the most part, but what about the adage about music can soothe the savage beast and the correlation of bad music versus good music and in relation to animals?
That's a good question, Kevin. Peter, what do you think?
Well, there used to be a program for playing music in dairy barns to increase the milk production because it produced contented cows. It's obviously animals respond to sound. My aunt had a dog who used to sit under the piano when my uncle played and look absolutely tranquil, but I don't think he was listening to music. I think he was listening to sounds. As far as soothing the savage breast, which I think is what it is, there is, of course, a long-standing idea that music can be used therapeutically on the emotions. Now, in a certain sense, it's true. Music has been used therapeutically. Indeed, you can get a degree in music therapy. But I don't think that has anything to do with the aesthetic question of what a person who's talking about music means when he says, this piece of music is anguished, this piece of music is cheerful. That, it seems to me, is just a question of what the properties of the music heard are.
Peter, but Kevin does raise an interesting question, and your response raises an interesting point, it seems to me. There's something about human psychology, the makeup of the human mind and brain, that makes it cognize music, and that makes it aware of music and hear music and experience music as an aesthetic object. And it's not at all clear that animals have that same psychological makeup. What do you think about that?
I quite agree. I think it very unlikely that animals listen to music. That doesn't mean that the kinds of sounds that we produce that are music to our ears, if you'll...
Right. So it might be that the homo musicanus or something, you know? I mean, people are always trying to find out what's distinctive about human beings, speech, tool use, maybe listening to music.
I haven't got a clue. I was once on a panel with Marvin Minsky from MIT, who's an amateur piano player, I think. And he suggested, well, maybe there's just some circuit left over from something in evolution that clicks on when we listen to the stuff we call music and pleasures us. But I haven't got a clue as to what the biological basis of music is, any more than I really have a clue about what the biological basis of appreciating the other arts is.
Well, I puzzled about one thing, is I can imagine an experiment to see if music soothes the savage beast. But what kind of experiment would you do to see if it soothes a savage breast?
Ooh, I can think of one. But you can't describe it on the radio. Paul in Albany's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Yes, well, when I looked at your website yesterday to see what you're going to be talking about, I thought you were going to talk a little bit more about universality of music. And a large amount of this conversation has been about, quote, classical music. And that would be like having a discussion of philosophy only about Greek philosophy. And I think music has a larger part to play in people's lives. Like, I'm from Ireland. When I hear Irish music, it evokes certain things in me from my childhood or whatever, even things that I'd forgotten about or didn't know. And as for Beethoven's Ode to Joy, all the big clubs in Europe, when they play soccer, instead of national anthems now, they play Ode to Joy.
So, Paul, thanks. Peter, so Paul's raising an interesting point. Music plays all kinds of roles in our lives. It defines who we are. It defines what group we belong to, what club we belong to, what class we belong to.
Certainly what generation we belong to in terms of popular music.
I mean, how's that work?
I just want to respond to that last question. Considering the level of violence at soccer games, it certainly gives the lie to the notion that music soothes the savage beast.
Yes, yes. But how's that work? Music as this kind of thing around which we rally and which defines us and which, you know, you say 1972, it's defined by certain music. My memories, anyway, of 1972 are defined partly by certain music. Why does that happen?
You know, the question of why music is a valuable part of culture is one of the most difficult questions I've ever confronted. It's particularly difficult with pure instrumental music. It's not as hard a question if you talk about music with a text. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, for example, has a long history in Europe of being used as a political rallying cry. And I think that can be explained through the text and through the culture of music in Europe, but it's very hard to find. Remember that Germany, which is one of the most musical countries in the Western world, produced not only Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, but the Holocaust. And Hangman Heydrich, whose name pretty much describes who he was a violinist who was deeply moved by the music of Schubert, I understand. So it's terribly hard to figure out what the relationship is, if any, between the culture of music and the rest of our culture. Nevertheless, I have a gut feeling, as I'm sure every one of my listeners does, that if we didn't have music, we would be an uncivilized and very impoverished culture.
You know, Peter, that was really the kind of question we wanted to get into, but we had such a flood of callers, and we're going to have you back sometime to talk about that issue, because I do think it's a very difficult question. So on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Peter Kivi. He's Board of Governors Professor of Philosophy at Rutgers University, author of many books on the philosophy of music, including An Introduction to the Philosophy of Music. So if you're just getting started into this subject, dig into that.
We also want to thank, we had quite a few callers that we weren't able to get to for reasons of time, and a few emails we didn't get a chance to read. So thanks anyway for your participation.
Yeah, the board was flooded at the end, and I hope you folks, you know, also flood that other board. So, John, what did we learn today? Is the music of philosophy resonating in your?
I didn't learn what music is or the bright conceptual analysis of music, but I learned something about what it isn't, what isn't going to work to define it, and Peter Kivi's own theory that music is intrinsically connected to the emotions, but not necessarily to the emotions you might at first mention. Is very intriguing. I'm going to have to look into his book and find a little bit more about what his positive theory is.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what the positive theory was either. And the negative theory seems maybe write to me. I'm not really sure. I find myself often moved to tears, moved to sadness, moved to great joy by music. I love music that just sort of takes over my consciousness. Just takes it over, and it's like all my thoughts, all my focus is on that music. And I don't know. I think the garden variety emotions are in there stewing around. But it's really mysterious. I mean, his theory would be good if it were right, because it's kind of mysterious since it has no representational content. You know, like if you're angry, you're not angry at anything, right? It's like, oh, that made me feel sad. Sad at what? Nothing happened. Nothing was represented at happening. So his theory would be nice if it
I remember
it
the first time I heard Ravel's Bolero, and for most people that has a lot of associations connected with lovemaking and so forth. But I was about 11 years old and really didn't have much experiential base for that.
Let's hope none.
But there was something about that music that just drew me in. I couldn't think about anything else until it was over. So that's kind of a paradigmatic musical experience. But what it all means, I don't know.
Well, you know what? To continue this conversation, I've already started it on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. Go check it out.
And you know, you can also download podcasts of our program. Just go to our website, follow the directions.
And in a few weeks, when we finally get this all settled down, you'll be able to download the complete archive of Philosophy Talk via podcast. So wait for further word on that. Joining us now on Philosophy Talk is Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW. They tell you how you can join the KALW family. How can they do that?
Well, it's a lot simpler than figuring out what music is. You just make a phone call, 800-525-9917, or go online at kalw.org. If you appreciate the fact that Ken and John really have a conversation, they listen to you, they talk to the other philosophers, and sometimes they just say, I don't know.
Yeah, often we say, I don't know. You know, you know what? I like to think of myself as a pretty accomplished philosopher, but doing this show has been humbling because there's so many things to talk about, and two-thirds of them I'm just thinking about Howard for the first time. So, you know, it's a challenge. This is like a feast. You know, it's spinach and it's roast beef and it's a quiche and it's great dessert. It's like a feast. And to keep this feast on the air, though, we need your help. Yeah. And you can give help by calling 1-800-525-9917 and pledge at whatever level you like. If you pledge at the $80 level, we've got a special gift for you. Now, not too many people took us up on this last week. I want some people to take us up on this because we've got these Philosophy Talk t-shirts. These are conversation starters. These are trend-setting, style-setting t-shirts. So you need to get one of those. 1-800-525-9917.
I understand that one of our callers was Paris Hilton and that she'll be wearing this t-shirt and you'll see her all over the place.
Oh, I don't
and,
know.
And everybody will want to have one.
She's
too.
Not a typical.
I may have that wrong.
Our typical audience member is a little more reflective than that.
Oh, well, one never knows. Maybe Paris, she likes a good intellectual buffet like you all provide on Philosophy Talk. There's probably some questions like, what is beauty? I'm sure she'd be interested in that one.
No, she'd say, I am beauty.
She could call in.
That's a category mistake.
Wasn't there music about that? I am beauty, hear me roar.
Right.
I am too.
1-800-525-9917. If they pledge at different levels, what are the goodies they can get?
There's also at the $60 level, if you can do that, we have these Freudian slips. They're great little post-it-like items that have Freud's representation of Freud on there. And they also say, when you say one thing, but you mean your mother. And they're just a good, definitely a good gift for somebody else or something just to have around the house to keep track of things. Most importantly, you'll make your support known for Philosophy Talk, 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. And I know, I saw, you know, for our new upcoming program guide, which goes out to all of our members, I saw the lineup you guys have for the fall, and it looks great. I'm very excited about it, and also excited that you'll be moving to Sunday mornings.
Sunday, right. Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. We're taking this show and moving it, and we really want you to move along with us. But before we move, I want you to give a parting gift.
Give us a push.
To KALW. Give us a nice send-off by pledging to support this show, showing Matt that you listened and you cared and you want to keep quality program on the air, and he's right to move us to Sunday. 1-800-525-9917.
We've been your Tuesday noon talk show, thought show, and we're going to become your Sunday thought show, we hope.
Yeah.
All thanks to KALW, so show your support.
And moving to Sunday is going to enable us to do amazing things. I think we will be, I'm not sure about this, but I believe we will be the only live call-in nationwide, potentially, because we'll be on the satellite, nationwide talk show that happens on Sunday. There are lots of programs that are pre-recorded and broadcast on Sunday. I think we'll be the only live call-in talk show broadcast on Sunday nationwide.
And it's exciting as you're reaching out to new folks. I'm sure we're going to hear some different kinds of questions about the philosophical.
Oh, yeah, from Asheville, North Carolina, and Louisiana,
Shreveport,
Louisiana. So we'll have all kinds of. There'll be an interesting conversation, and we'll want you to be part of it. But to tell Matt and this station that you do want to be part of it. It takes a pledge. 1-800-525-9917.
Absolutely. Keep that money rolling into KALW. It makes good use of it. You wander around the station here, you don't see any frills. You don't see any wasted money. We put the coffee through the coffee grounds 3 or 4 times every morning. You know, and
you can't believe everything John Perry says.
Well, at any rate. And then we want to be your Sunday morning thought show. We want you to curl up with your Chronicle Funnies and your New York Times crossword, or the Chronicle crossword too, and your radio, and listen to Philosophy Talk.